Happy New Year and welcome to 2025's first episode of Howling Talent, the beginning of our third season, shedding light on human and animal talents in all fields. Also, a very happy birthday to my partner in crime, Yvonne. I'm Anna Roy.
Thank you. And I'm Yvonne Dagger. Let's get howling. Today, we welcome Sarah Fenwick, jazz singer, journalist, artist, a mentor for us in Howling Talent, and our main topic for today, an author. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you very much for having me, and happy birthday, Yvonne.
Thank you so much. Sarah, you are Anglo-Cypriot, but born in Kenya and now living in Germany. You study journalism, media, and advertising at the University of Wisconsin, lived in the Republic of Cyprus for many years, opened Sarah's jazz club in Nicosia, and during COVID developed your passion for art and fiction writing. Whew! That's all I can say. Wow.
Well,
yeah, when you put it like that, it's quite tiring, actually.
Well, in 2023, you released your debut novel, The Light Walker, that combines historical fiction with elements of magical realism. And in one scene, you discuss what happened to dogs in Cyprus during the 1974 invasion by Turkey. As in any conflict, society was disrupted and families the animals lived with lost their homes. Tell us about their story and what inspired you to include this theme in The Light Walker.
Well, it stood out to me because I was about 8 years old at the time, and I was terribly concerned for the dogs because they had caught echinococcosis. And unfortunately, they had to be put down, and it broke my heart at the time. But there was no other choice because it was a very contagious disease, and it was spreading to the human population as well. So that is basically why I added it to the book, which is to show the horrors of war, both for the human and animal populations.
And you are now in your final year in taking your writing course. Sarah, can you tell us a little something about it?
Yeah, with pleasure. When I started writing fiction, it was after 30 years as a journalist and pretty much sticking to the facts. And when I sort of felt this call to write fiction, which was of this very, very high mountain to me, something that I even worshipped because I'm a big reader. And I never really thought that I could do fiction writing. But the Light Walker came out of me during COVID. I had a lot of time on my hands because Sarah's Jazz Club was closed for the period, and most of the time, and I had to do some writing. And the story just came to me. But I realized that from feedback from people who were kind enough to read the first drafts, that it was missing some techniques, and I had to reevaluate how I was going to approach fiction. And I applied for a master's program in creative writing, and luckily, and I was very thankful to be accepted at the University of Hull. And I've got another 6 months or so to go, but I've learned an immense amount about fiction writing and creative writing in nonfiction as well. It's improved my writing 100%. As I said, I was very grateful to have that experience, and I can't wait to continue writing with all the new techniques and methods that I've learned, and be able to put into writing some of the philosophies that I have, some of the things I think about life, what I would like to spread, which is universal creative energy, and the fact that we're here as a miracle, We should be able to, appreciate our precious lives.
That's wonderful. There's so much power in the pen, right?
There is indeed. There is a.
It's a wonderful thing. And as a journalist, now you're, I mean, you are a journalist, and now you've, taken these courses and learned so much, and you're now a writer for many years. And you've told us what lessons, but what is the most important lesson that you've taken away from this experience?
I think the most important lesson is that as writers, like if I were giving other writers advice, I would say that your first draft is just your first draft, and you're constantly going to be refining it, improving it, finding out where you can bring more things out. So I think that is the most important thing, because I know a lot of writers believe that, their first draft, maybe it's not so good, or, it disappoints them. It doesn't seem like the books that they've read. But that's actually because the real writing is in the redrafts and in the edits. And I think that is sort of given me a lot of courage and way to look at my writing in a fresh way. To know my strengths, to know my weaknesses, and to know where to focus my editing on, which areas to focus my editing on. So I think it's a very real development, and quite down to earth thing, that we might have big dreams as writers, and we admire all the greats and so on. But actually, what it comes down to is this sort of granular approach to our writing that is, evaluating and being real about what you do well and what you don't do so well, and compensating for that, and constantly improving your weaknesses in writing. I think you can improve your weaknesses, and be confident in your strengths. I hope that makes sense.
No,
Definitely.
certainly that's real, well, wonderful lesson. And it's almost great, I guess, to walk away for a little bit and then come back in again. Do you find that if you walk away
Oh,
and then take a break and then go back and it's fresh, you see something different in it, or do something different, so that first draft is, not
this is
critical.
so valuable. Yeah, it's so valuable when you walk away, and I think it's about seeing the work again. So, because your first draft, especially, you sort of end up in this, you've dumped all the words onto the page, and you've got this great big passion and great big energy, which is very, very good to have in your first draft. That's what it should be. And when you walk away and you come back at it a few days later, a few weeks later, sometimes months later, you can actually see it with a fresh eye and say, okay, I appreciate what that was, but now we're going to shape it. Now it's ready to be sculpted,
Oh, that's brilliant. Brilliant.
Well, animals help us to tell stories and get in touch with our creative selves. In mythology, they are messengers between the real world and other dimensions. And mythology is a subject that fascinates you. Can you explain why and give us some examples of animals used and what they represent? For example, you use the screech owl Bree in your short story, Queen Anne's Lace.
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic in mythology. Animals are everywhere. I mean, they really symbolize the communication. They symbolize many things. Bree, for example, symbolize the connection between the underworld and the waking world, let's say, the shadow world and the waking world. And she was a talk. She was a talking owl. Sorry, he was a talking owl, who communicated with the main character, and led her deeper and deeper and deeper into the forest, where she was getting to know herself, and coming to terms with what happened to her earlier in the story. That's from a story called Queen Anne's Lace. And I don't know, I think that animals, because they have no artifice about them, perhaps. They don't pretend. They know how to fit into hierarchies, but they don't have any kind of pretentiousness about them or anything like that. So in a way, it frees us as artists to sort of get in touch with our own creativity. And I don't know quite how that would work psychologically or something, but it just seems that it's a sort of direct communication between us and nature.
Yes,
Beautiful.
definitely. Are there any other animals that you've used or are thinking of using that are that mean something to you, that have influenced?
Yes, I'm actually very excited because I'm about to start on developing my second fiction book, it would be. This will be targeted at children 8 to 12 years old, and it's called Roxy, and it's based on loosely on a real life story about a rabbit with whom I encountered, and of course, this is sort of how us writers we get inspiration. We'll have an encounter in our lives, and then we run with it. At least in fiction, it's very loose basis on life. It's just sort of things that suddenly pop up and inspire us and capture our imaginations. And so Roxy is a rabbit who's searching for his family. And so that's going to be the next 6 months of my life.
That. I love that. I love that. And you are currently working on Soul Tracker, the sequel to The Light Walker. Soul Tracker has themes of climate change, and lions are envisioned as museum pieces after they go extinct because of desertification as global temperatures rise. Can you tell us a little bit about this and how did you come up with these ideas? Climate change?
Well, oh, that's a great question, Yvonne. They just sort of gel together after decades and decades of being an environmentalist. I care very much about the environment. I care very much about humans living in balance with other species on this earth that we're on for a short while. So, Soul Tracker is a continuation of the second book in the Light Walker series. And Rebecca, the main character, is quite frightened by what's happening with climate change. And she imagines in one of the scenes, she imagines that actually all the lions are extinct. The climate change has gone to the point where there is a lot of desertification and no place for them to, the plant life dies out, animal life dies out that they prey on, and then finally they die out and they're preserved in museums. And in perfectly, because the temperatures are so high, their boxes, their transparent boxes are, how do we say, at humidity levels that allow them to retain, sort of be in one piece. So this is a scene in, it seems quite sort of dystopic, so dystopian, that's the word. She got to it there. It seems quite dystopian, but it's not too far away if we don't stop climate change and global temperatures from rising quite as fast as they are.
Well, bravo to you. Wow. And as a journalist, and also as an artist, I mean, I can't believe you do so many things. God, you're just wonderful.
Thank
You're a
you.
renaissance, lady. But do you have you used them and written about them in your in your articles or your journalism articles and your artwork? Them?
Did you mean animals or
Animals, the animals.
yes, yeah. So with animals in art, I combine them. I get quite playful in the sense that I like to combine them with some sort of metaphysical ideas. For example, Schrödinger's cat experiment, which talks about probabilities. I've drawn a cat based on one of my cats, Tiger, in a box, looking at himself in the mirror and sort of contemplating his existence and thinking how handsome he is. So it's sort of like this sort of playful idea. As when I was learning to paint and draw, I also drew my dog Shoppy, and I would also include him in the future book Roxy. Now, as far as journalism is concerned and animals, yes, I have covered some animal stories in the past to do with sort of how animals in the zoos are treated. Or how sustainability applies to the animal world, and sort of keeping the environment clean, non-polluted as much as possible, because of course animals are part of our environment. So yes, I'm interested in all three areas in the animal world, definitely. But I wouldn't call myself an animal painter. I tend to combine it more with sort of different ideas that I have,
You
but
come up
definitely
with,
in fiction. Yeah,
yeah.
sorry. Yeah.
You come up with an idea first, and then you put it on the picture plane, or and you draw it and paint it, or do you draw it first, like just get it out and draw it first, and then think of a title for it?
Yeah, good question. Mostly I think of a title after I've drawn it. And sometimes, because during the creative process, the idea develops or sparks up
Sure.
and it becomes what it's going to become. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a little bit of combination of both, but mostly afterwards. Yeah.
Good for you.
I'm a
Wow.
fan of seeing what pops up
Yeah,
in your subconscious. You never know.
I think it's wonderful. Wow. Really nice.
Well, a few years
Thank you.
ago, you were diagnosed with ADHD. Can you explain what it is and how it affects you and your writing process? You've also created a journal to help other authors keep their ideas and writing in order too. How has that helped you?
Oh, wow, great questions. Right. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, is becoming more well known as a sort of condition, a different brain condition. They differentiate it as neurodivergence compared to neurotypical brain structures. And there are a few sort of medical things that I could probably not go into here because it's a little bit long-winded, but basically, all the things that you mentioned that I do, for example, Yvonne, you mentioned I do all of these things earlier. I think a lot of it has to do with quite a big amount of creativity. And also, part of ADHD is the default network, which is part of the brain that switches off when somebody who is neurotypical is not doing a task. So neurotypicals, they do a task, they finish the task, and then their brain sort of switches off from that task. But in people with ADHD, that part of the brain doesn't switch off. So you're still constantly thinking about that task. It's still sort of running through your mind, and it also affects your ability to focus on the next task.
Right.
This is a very simplistic way of looking at it. But what does that mean in practice? It means that I'm constantly creating something. I'm constantly going. My mind is, I would say, quite busy. I always have a song going on, which is quite nice. But then there are other other layers of my mind that are sort of popping things up from here and there. And it also means that I pull things laterally from left and right, forward and back, come up with ideas that might not have been thought to be combined, but I can find a way to combine them. So this adds to the creativity as well, which I actually find it quite exciting. And then, ADHD, it affects every part of my life and my creative life. I've learned to sort of harness it, have coping mechanisms for all kinds of different situations, like this one, in which I've actually forgotten the second part of the question, Anna.
Well, basically, I asked how it affects your writing process and also how has the journal that you've created to help authors help
Ah,
you?
yes. Right. How it affects my writing.
Yeah.
Well, it affects my writing quite a lot because I have to take a lot of breaks. I can't really sustain focus for a long time unless I get into hyper focus. And this is sort of random. You can't tell when it's going to happen or not. It all has to do with the level of dopamine neurotransmitters in your brain, which are responsible for focus. And however, once I realized that, all I have to do is just sort of keep taking mini breaks and maybe paint a bit instead, or maybe go sing a song actually instead, do little things that have like mini deadlines, then I know I'll just keep refocusing, and coming back to it. Now, the writer's notebook really, really helped me. It was something that I needed to do for myself to organize all of the elements of writing, in main elements of writing, and taking notes into one big fat notebook. It's over 350 pages. It's categorized into sections of situation, location, characterization, sensory details and timeline, and free form notes. Now, how does this help somebody with ADHD, or actually any writer,
Any writer.
is that when we are perceiving the world around us, which is what writers do, and then they sort of transfer it into articles or into fiction and what have you, this is our raw material, and it's very easily forgotten. So if we are actually perceiving our world around us, and we're thinking in terms of the categories of raw material, it's surprising how many impressions we can gain. Last year I took over 330 notes, all of which are usable in world building. So these are the sort of small details that perhaps, if we're not looking for them, we'll ignore them. Did somebody wear a red coat? Why did that person's expression change? What was the tone of their voice? What fruits were laid out? I mean, it's a constant input that's coming into your mind as you go around your day. So this has really helped me a lot, because it's not just a matter of writing down free form notes that are not sort of in the end tied to something I could develop later on as a book, or as a characterization. I hope I answered all of those, all parts of the
You certainly
question.
did. You
Yeah,
certainly did.
wow, that was so helpful.
Do you have a favorite time to write during the day?
Sorry?
Do you have a favorite time of day that you write or whenever it comes to you?
Well, I write between, I would say, 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. And because of this intermittent focus that I have, I will just have it open and I will go through the day, just sort of popping in and out of the manuscript. So I don't really have a specific time, like some people can say I write from 5 to 7 or something like that. It's all through the day, and I just sort of slip back into the focus as many times as possible. So it might be 5 minutes, it might be half an hour, it might be 5 hours. I never can tell.
That's wonderful. That's great. Well, thank you. That was such a great way of looking into that, into ADHD. Because we need an explanation every once in a while. And you did touch on Roxy, a book that you are well, it'll be out in 2026. And you said it's a story about a rabbit trying to find his family, and that it's for children 8 to 12 years old. And the idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea is to help children have empathy towards animals and tell a story in an imaginative way to highlight their ability to have their own attachments and relationships with animals. Why is this important to you to give animals a character voice? And what type of research did you have to do for this book? If
It's
any,
important.
if any.
Great question. Thank you. It's important because, of course, children's psychology, as we've sort of realized through psychological analysis and many, many, many studies, is formative. For example, when they are sensitized to animals, they tend to have more compassion in general, and the media that they consume is very, very influential on what eventually they're going to, how they're going to end up perceiving animals. And on the darker side, psychopathology, sociopathology indicates that children who mistreat animals are quite likely to grow up having a big problem fitting into society, and they're more likely to tr mistreat people as well. So I've always been quite keen to promote the idea of children having empathy towards animals. Now, over the years, this has also become quite a different ball game, because it's grown into people like Jonathan Birch, because I was researching him today actually, and Jonathan Birch is a professor of philosophy, and he's very, very advanced in philosophical discussions and let's say research about animal sentience. And he basically asks a very simple question, you know, from the animal's point of view: does it feel pain? Does it feel pleasure? Does it form attachments in it and navigate through its own life, you know, with a consciousness? And his conclusion is yes, they do. So this to me has sort of all slotted in nicely to make the basis of a children's book that tells a story in a emotionally sort of perspective for of the animal. So from Roxy's perspective, how he would feel looking for his family, for example, and how his behavior is, how he relates to the adults around him, how he relates to the other animals around him. And it's less though a sort of fairy tales idea, or you know, it's less to do with anthropomorphizing the animal and making it more like a sort of smaller human. It's much more about making the animal appear in its own network of relationships and its own way of surviving life, thriving in life, and so on. So it's not going to be so much about It's not going to be, it's going to be a very difficult thing to get across as a writer. So I'm going to need quite a lot of all of my talents, let's say, to really communicate with children. And I do plan to do some readings for children's groups. I was very happy to hear today that one of the schools that I have emailed requesting that I could do some readings and get the children's feedback so that it really does do what I want it to do. They said yes, so that's great. I'm looking
Wonderful.
forward to researching in real life, let's say getting real life experiences. Because you can never tell. I mean, it's one thing to have a theory and want to do something and have the intention. It's another thing to make it practically happen. Yeah.
Sure. And I think it's so brilliant on your part to be able to go into the schools. And now the readings, are they part of the book? Would they be part of the book that you with Roxy and including her voice or his voice to the other animals and to the adults? What is that what you would bring to the children to see what their reaction would be? Or
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way. I'll give it some thought. The idea was to do the reading and then let the kids ask me questions about the story itself or that part of the reading that they had and see what their response is and see if they did actually empathize with Roxy, if they did see it as a character voice. With consciousness and with its own preferences, likes, dislikes, attitudes towards life, around it. And I think that would be, at the moment I'm thinking about it just really more about as part of the research, but yeah, that would be great to include some of the questions that the kids ask. I mean, they're a tough audience,
They really are. They're very, very honest. Children, if you want really want to know the truth, they're the best little people to ask. So, I think this is so good on your part to be able to do and to go into the schools and to ask. They're going to tell you the truth. Yeah, they're a tough audience.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how they interpret what you are trying to tell them, and
Yeah,
you'll get a
very
good gauge
interesting.
as to whether or not you're actually getting the message across as you want it to come across.
Exactly. And I'm going to have to also be honest with myself as well. Like, if it's not coming across and they're not getting, I'm also going to have to think about the possibility that the story is not coming across and that it's not appealing to them, that they're not connecting with it. And that's also, I suppose, the sort of research part of it is to be honest with yourself and say, well, you're going to have to do some editing here, and address their concerns. Perhaps they're concerned about a different thing than I was concerned to write about. And they're going to probably bring up a lot of fresh ideas that I haven't even thought about at all. I mean, this is a generation. Or that are being brought up in unprecedented times, of where they have access to all kinds of information, although parents probably do try to keep it, sort of as much as possible, restricted still, it sort of gets around, that there's people talk all the time, kids over here. I'm not sure what they understand, what they don't understand. So I'm going to keep an open mind myself, actually.
Yeah, that's great. Wow.
So how can people follow your journey on social media, and where can they purchase your books?
Right, so my books are available on Amazon. They can find me on social media. I'm on Facebook, Sarah Fenwick Author. Also on my website, sarahfenwickauthor.com. Sarahfenwickauthor.com, you'd be able to contact me if you have any questions. I'm also on Instagram as far as the art is concerned. I'm around.
That's good to know. Well, one final question. If you were in an animal, what animal would you be and why?
Oh, I would be a cat.
All right.
I would be a cat because cats are cool, man. I love
that jazz
that. I love that.
thing.
I love that.
Well, Sarah, you and I have been close friends for many years, and I consider it a privilege that we are a sounding board for each other's work and ideas on a regular basis. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And it goes without saying that we'll have you back to discuss Roxy in more detail when the time comes for its release.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been an honor, absolute pleasure to speak with you both. And
Thank
yeah,
you.
all the best with your podcast. It's wonderful.
Aw,
Thank
thank you
you.
so much, Sarah.
Well, to our wonderful listeners, thank you for continuing to follow us on Howling Talent's journey. And please tune in to all our podcast episodes on our website, howlingtalent.com, our Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And do share on social media. We enjoy your company, and new listeners are, of course, always welcome. So until next time, happy listening and take care.